It is kind of interesting. We're going to whipsaw from the founding of the country and the original drafting of the Constitution to pleading today. So we're going to cover a couple centuries worth of progress here and do something exceptionally practical with this discussion of pleading standards. And we have two excellent people to discuss this, both very experienced IP litigators. Christian Mammon is the executive partner of Hogan Lovells, San Francisco office. He's been litigating patents and technology cases since the last century in particularly information technology domains. And Mikkel Vikkel is a partner at White & Case's Silicon Valley office, and he likewise has a successful track record litigating complex patent cases, district courts, ITC, and Federal Circuit. Please welcome Christian and Mikkel. Thank you.
All right, so thanks for joining us on this today. There's been a lot of interesting things starting to happen in the intersection between federal rules of civil procedure and patent law. It was almost exactly a year ago that the rules amending the federal rule, that the amendments to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure went into effect, abrogating Rule 84 and the Appendix of Forms, and importantly for us, getting rid of Form 18.
And we have a number of recent district court decisions that shed some light on how the new rule is going to be interpreted. There's no clear guidance, but hopefully part of this discussion today will help us give a better picture of how we should be pleading patent infringement claims. Our presentation relates to direct infringement. Indirect infringement is already subject to the Iqbal Twombly standard. And before we get started, I just want to ask Chris a question. With respect to this interplay between Rule 84 and Form 18, where do these forms come from?
So I was a little bit worried. We were talking about this beforehand. I was a little bit worried that the talking about the this old legal history was going to be a little bit too academic, but
given it's not that, as old as Madison.
Given that we've just been talking about Madison, I'm a little bit relieved to delve into this. But back in the 1940s, when the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure were initially adopted, it was a pretty revolutionary idea to have rules providing notice pleading and the whole structure that was set up and replaced the existing code pleading standards in the 1940s. And a lot of the discussion was, well, how are we going to know exactly what's required? And so to reassure those skeptics, the drafters put together an appendix of forms and then added a rule that said, just in case you're wondering, here's some examples of what's good enough. And so Form 18 was one of the original forms that was an example. It was provided back in the 1940s for what would be a sufficient pleading. And as we saw over the ensuing 75 years or so, the initial concept really didn't take into account thoroughly the transaction costs of actually litigating cases, and that's what created a lot of the pressure to move past the appendix of forms.
So here we have the old pleading standard. This was a favorite of first-year associates because it just required a generic template for a patent complaint. We had the form that had five basic allegations: the jurisdiction, the who owns the patent, that the defendant infringed, whether the patentee gave notice, and whether there was a request for an injunction. And as Chris pointed out, the Federal Circuit had held that Form 18 was sufficient for a direct infringement cause of complaint, and it was sufficient to survive a motion to dismiss, despite what the Supreme Court said in Iqbal Twombly. We now have a new pleading standard that was abrogated on December 1st, 2015. And really what this requires is the plausibility standard that we found in the indirect infringement claims to also apply to the direct infringement claims. And essentially, the focus of the inquiry is on whether the patentee has pled a plausible claim for relief.
So Bijal, what does that mean? What does it mean to allege a plausible claim for relief?
Hey, that's a Federal Circuit question. But like we don't know what 101 means, here we also have a variety of different cases. in my view, it should make it. It should mean a case that an infringement case can rest on its laurels based on the complaint. And we'll go through the cases that go into this in a much deeper fashion.
So what have we seen happen over the course of the past year? There have been a number of motions to dismiss for failure to state a claim in patent cases that have been filed. And as I'm sure many of you know, before this rules change, for direct infringement claims, a motion to dismiss or a challenge to the pleading was all but pointless. And so this is a new way to challenge the case up front. And those who've looked more closely at the data have noted that as much as 44% of the time, these motions succeed. The question is, you know, does the complaint plausibly allege infringement of at least one claim? You know, with the notion that, you know, a missing claim element or just sort of conclusively reciting the claim language is generally not enough.
And Chris, before we move forward, so if I'm a defendant in a case and I'm faced with this proverbial question, do I file a motion for failure to state a claim, or do I just wait because many jurisdictions have local patent rules that give us more information in the infringement contentions? And it's probably unlikely that the court may even hear the motion before I get the infringement contentions.
No, so that's a good point. If the inquiry or if the motion is solely to try and get more information about what the lawsuit is about, it is possible that between the interaction of, you know, filing a motion to dismiss on the original complaint and maybe getting an amended complaint and so forth, by the time that that's decided by the judge, if you're in a jurisdiction that has patent local rules or otherwise requires early disclosures, you may have found out what those contentions are. But at the same time, it's worth doing for a couple of reasons. One is that this is a standard under the federal rules that you have to have a sufficient complaint, and it's worth insisting on that. It's also potentially a way to for defendants to lay down a marker with the judge and say, you know, we think this complaint does not pass muster. Now, the judge may deny the motion, but it may nonetheless influence the court's thinking as the case proceeds and sort of have the effect of raising the bar on other things, such as the sufficiency of the disclosures later on. So it's worth pursuing. It's something that was not really on the table at all before this change and is now definitely a part of the toolbox that the defendants should consider and examine. So one of the challenges, though, is because we don't have a Federal Circuit ruling yet, and probably given sort of the sequence of litigation, it may be another year or two before we do have some guidance from the Federal Circuit, we have a lot of different district courts applying a lot of different standards or a lot of different assessments to determine what they think is plausible. How much needs to be included in a complaint to be plausible? And so I think sort of as a general matter, we can bracket this. And we can say at one extreme, at the very minimum, we think that the Twombly-Iqbal standard requires at least as much as Form 18 did. So that's sort of the minimum. And then, you know, a reasonable maximum to think about is what the patent local rule infringement contentions require as being, you know, a complaint shouldn't necessarily be required to include more than is required to be in those initial contentions. So we have a range that's sort of the more plausible range or the more reasonable range to require, but different judges have come to some very different conclusions within that range, and we're seeing a lot of lot of experimentation among plaintiffs and judges trying to sort out what this means. So we thought we'd take a look at a handful of cases, and this is by no means a scientific selection, but rather several illustrative examples of what we've seen come down the pike so far, and I think that'll help us frame our thinking about this. So the first case is the Atlas IP case, and this is a complaint that was filed on November 30th, 2015, and for those of you who follow the statistics, that was the day before the new rules came into effect, and there were about 800 patent infringement complaints filed that day. It was perhaps the biggest ever post-Thanksgiving patent infringement frenzy ever. And so the Atlas IP case is one where our friends at Duri Tangri filed a challenge to the complaint, and ultimately there was a second amended complaint that was filed, and it alleged infringement of one claim. It left some gaps and still included a lot of fairly conclusory language saying the accused products include, paraphrase the claim limitation. Next paragraph in the complaint, the accused products include, paraphrase. And this was one where the court concluded that it was not sufficient. You know, moreover, the accused products were generically referred to as the defendant's smart meters, not specifically identifying specific products. And so the other thing that's interesting is this complaint, by the second amended complaint, actually included a four-page element-by-element claim chart of claim one, which sounds impressive. If you look at the complaint, though, it provides a nice narrative with lots of words saying what the accused instrumentalities were alleged to include, but there was no citation to specific evidence or specific features. It was just a sort of a conclusory description. So it was a nice framing of it, but was still held not to pass muster. So simply including a claim chart may not be enough. Another case is the Rain Dance case, and this case is one that took quite a while to make its way through the courts. It was originally filed in February 2015, and so it was the original complaint and even the amended complaint were filed before the rules changes. They were basic Form 18 pleadings. And Judge Andrews in the District of Delaware held that in his discretion, he was going to apply the new rules and found that the complaint did not do a good enough job connecting the dots between the accused products and the asserted claim limitations, and in fact left some gaps. And so on that basis, he granted a motion to dismiss that claim as well.
Okay, we've got two other cases. Forgive me if I mispronounce this. This is Asghari versus USAA in our favorite Rocket Docket, the Eastern District of Virginia. And this case generally related to encryption technologies used on a financial services website, the two-step authentication that we've all come to either love or hate on those sites. And the plaintiff had alleged that four features infringe at least claims 1 through 13, 16 through 42, and 45 through 55. Now, this was done in the pre-December 1st, 2015 world. The Eastern District of Virginia dismissed the complaint. It stated that there was no identification of any features on the website that correspond to particular elements identified in the patent. There was no explanation of how each feature on the website infringed the patent. And it only focused on independent claim one when there were a number of other independent claims at issue. So what do these plaintiffs do? 3 weeks after the new rules come out, they file an amended complaint. And here, you'll see a little more description. The court did find that there are these key phrases in the patent, the central entity, the user, and the external entity. You saw the same vagueness with respect to the asserted claims, the words at least, which really puts the defendant in a difficult spot because they then have to prepare for all of them, since at least is just a small subset. And the accused instrumentality, as you can see on this slide, was a lot more descriptive. It says here, through use of an authentication system, a logon service, a PIN number reset service, and it went through some more detail. The Eastern District of Virginia held that the amended complaint was insufficient for three main reasons. One is it failed to specify the parts of the website that correspond to the infringing claims. It fails to identify with particularity which feature infringes the website. And finally, it only included one independent claim when there were other independent claims at issue. So going back to a comment that Chris made earlier, long gone are those days of just pleading one independent claim. Next, we have an example of a district court that applied a lower standard recently. And this is in the Central District of California, the Incom Walt Disney case. This is interesting RFID technology, so Disney can track where you go and spend your money in their parks and also track when you are shopping for Mickey Mouse ears. Here, this complaint was filed before the new rules went into effect, and the court here held that the spirit of the amendments to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure require that the court adopt the new standard, despite the timing of the filing of the complaint. And here, the plaintiff had identified specific accused products, the Magic Band, the My Magic Plus. They described the unique functions at the Disney parks. There was no element-by-element analysis, and there was no description for more than one independent claim. And here, the claim was held valid, and so the complaint was not dismissed.
All right. So, you know, if we sort of distill all of that, what do you see as sort of the recommended best practices for plaintiffs who are drafting complaints?
Well, plaintiffs should spend more time up front, right? This is going to require a little bit more due diligence on their part. They should focus on, this is very hard for me because I'm always representing a defendant, but putting this aside, they should focus on more than one independent claim if they plan to assert that. And they should really map each of the features of the patent to a feature of the defendant's product. Okay. That at a bare minimum. Obviously, it's going to depend on a case-by-case basis.
All right. And you know, we'll talk in a moment about sort of some of the other practical effects. But I think it's important to have in mind that's sort of the new regime we're living in, is where there's that kind of specificity that's going to be required. What has been the effect on patent litigation activity? We took a look at the data from the year before the rules went into effect, so the year ending November 30th, 2015, and compared it with the year just ended. And you know, I've got the same data here in a table form, maybe a little easier to follow. The absolute number of patent infringement cases that have been filed has dropped considerably nationwide, about 25%. It's down even more significantly in the Eastern District of Texas, and is even down substantially in the Northern District of California.
So, Chris, a quick question. Obviously, plaintiffs and non-practicing entities are well-funded. They have smart lawyers working with them. Is the pleading standard the sole cause of this decline?
No, I think there's been, I think it's a important contributing factor, but it's probably hard to tease out how the many changes in the patent law that have come about in the past several years have really driven these numbers. You know, we've got obviously the Section 101 set of issues, the introduction of IPRs, some uncertainty about venue with the TC Heartland case, and also various rulings on damages from apportionment and high, you know, increased standards of proof and the changes in the Frand law as well. So I think all of those are probably contributing factors to this overall decline, but certainly the increased bar for what has to go into a complaint necessarily has an effect on some of the more bare bones complaints, the reduction in the number of more bare bones complaints that have been filed.
So just following up on what Chris mentioned, what's the effect on litigants because of this heightened pleading standard? Plaintiffs need to include more detail in their complaints. We see that complaints in the Eastern District of Texas have identified, almost 90% of them have identified an accused instrumentality and one claim. But really, what are the practical effects here? And you can read all this on the slides, but this is really going to help possibly accelerate cases. You're going to have, if you have more information in the complaint, it's going to allow the defendant to possibly file its 101 motion earlier. It may allow the defendant to file an invalidity motion even before claim construction, because the claim constructions are so clear by looking at the infringement contentions. So really, if the core purpose of these rules are to promote judicial efficiency and to allow the defendants to move the cases forward in a productive manner, then a defendant can certainly take advantage of all of these new rules in order to do so.
And that's, you know, that's consistent with sort of the overall purpose of the recent amendments to the federal rules, to try and shorten some of the time frames up front and get the case moving faster. And this seems to be a change that will help that go as well.
One other point to note is the interplay between the heightened pleading standards and the patent local rules. So, for example, in the Northern District of California, you can only amend your infringement contentions for good cause. And if we take us out of the mindset of amending because of claim construction, one could see a future where litigants are starting to point the fingers at the plaintiff. If the plaintiff had enough to submit a 10-page complaint, then why are they asking the court to amend their infringement contentions later? They could have done this at the time that they filed the complaint. So it's going to be interesting to see how both plaintiffs and defendants use these new rules to advocate their positions.
Bijal, what about Rule 11 investigations? And you know, that's something where the law has been relatively stable for a while, but do you see that the new pleading standards are going to impact that analysis as well?
Yeah, I definitely do. The Rule 11 analysis was really not used as a defense by most defendants because we had this Form 18 standard. And now that that's been abrogated, you might see an increase in litigants making claims to see where was the Rule 11 basis from the beginning, particularly if they cannot amend their complaints. And we've seen a number of examples where complaints have been amended 1, 2, 3 times, and if the plaintiff still can't get it right, I would see an increase in the Rule 11 type of request.
Okay, but the in some sense the standard also for Rule 11 investigation dovetails nicely with what we're seeing as needing to be included more robustly in patent infringement complaints. Some other factors to watch. Until we get some concrete guidance from the Federal Circuit on this, forum selection is going to be even more important than it has been, because we'll see different courts applying different standards somewhere in that range between the old Form 18 standard and something as potentially as high as preliminary infringement contentions as the pleading standard. And so as different courts settle in, that will become important. That may also be impacted if venue reform is taken up either by the courts or by Congress. And then another place that I think is going to be really interesting is another amendment that we haven't discussed to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure was to change Rule 26 to eliminate that familiar trope that we all learned in law school, that discovery is proper if it's reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. That's gone. Discovery is proper only if it is relevant to any claim or defense. And so if we are now looking at a universe where the pleading has to be more specific and has to more specifically identify the asserted claims, at least one asserted claim and at least one asserted accused product, is there a a reasonable argument that discovery should be limited to the actual asserted claim and the actual accused product, or somehow bounded in that regard under these changes to the discovery rules. We haven't seen activity on that front yet, but that might be a really interesting place to strategize.
And here's what's keeping me up at night. Could you see a change in pleading of defenses? The FRC amendments eliminated Form 30, which was the generic boilerplate template asserting affirmative defenses. And if those rules change by the interpretation by the court, is that going to require and place a heavier burden on defendants to plead all of their defenses, to maintain those, to seek those 101 and invalidity defenses out early in the case? So again, this is more front-loading of the work earlier on in the case.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think this could be a place where plaintiffs may exert some counter leverage in filing motions to attack affirmative defenses early on, just to put the defense to the test. Before the rules changes, there were a split among district courts about whether or not they applied, and there was no definitive appellate decision about what standard needed to be met for affirmative defenses. And so, you know, at the same time, there was Form 30 that provided some examples of bare-bones affirmative defenses. With that gone, has the balance tipped in favor of requiring more detail? That remains to be seen, but it's also something interesting to keep an eye on.
And it's another tool in the bucket of a plaintiff or a non-practicing entity that's facing, you know, the litany of motions that defendants bring, like 101 and motions to transfer and Iqbal Twombly motions. Yep. And with that, we feel the very heavy weight of the break that's coming up. So if there aren't any questions, oh, go ahead.
Yeah. So the question is whether the Twombly-Iqbal standard applies to counterclaims for or declaratory judgment for invalidity or non-infringement, and I have to say I've seen some case law on that, but we didn't drill into that, and so I don't have it top of mind right now. But there has been some case law addressing that issue. I don't know, Bijal, if you.
I encountered this recently in a case, so from personal experience, I can tell you, Brandon, that in my view, the same rules would apply with respect to the plausibility standard for those counterclaims. At least that's the best practice. Any other questions? Yes, Professor Mark. Lemley.
Say something about the last bullet point here. What's the rationale behind not applying the plausibility standard to affirmative defenses here, right? We seem to be moving in the opposite direction with respect to complaints. Why not the same with defenses?
Well, I'm going to look to you to defend that, because I tend to think that there should be a higher standard applied to defenses.
Well, one could make the counter argument that the defendant hasn't had the same amount of due diligence to come up with its defenses at the time that it's required to file the complaint, as the plaintiff has had unlimited amounts of time to file and submit its, you know, opening allegations. I defer to you, Chris.
Yeah. You know, at the same time, so often it's, you know, you reflexively put in the same litany of 8 or 10 one-line affirmative defenses, you know, if you're diligent, you at least try and say, okay, what's our Rule 11 basis for this? Or what's our good faith basis for this? And but don't really put in any detail. And I think that I would argue that fairness requires putting in at least a little more detail to get those moving forward in a more open fashion. Whether or not courts are willing to buy into that or not, I don't, it remains to be seen. Anything else? All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.